Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Eric J. Dolan, whose new book is A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. We'll also hear from Sandy Rosenthal, founder of the group Levees.org, whose new book is Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina. Eric J. Dolan is an historian with a fascination for maritime topics, lighthouses, whaling, pirates, to name only a few. In his new book, he takes on a topic of dread and fascination for New Orleans readers. It's called A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. He's speaking to us today from his home in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Eric J. Dolan, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you'd start by reading one of the book's epigraphs from a teenager named Alexander Hamilton. And that was written in 1772.
This is the teenage Alexander Hamilton. He is writing a letter to his father about a hurricane that slammed into his home island of St. Croix. And he says, "Good God, what horror and destruction. It seemed as if a total dissolution of nature was taking place. The roaring of the sea and wind, fiery meteors flying about in the air, the prodigious glare of almost perpetual lightning, the crash of the falling houses, and the ear-piercing shrieks of the distressed were sufficient to strike astonishment into the angels." And what's particularly interesting about that letter is the wealthy people on St. Croix were so impressed by this young man's writing that they banded together, raised a significant amount of money, and paid to send him off to New York to further his education. And that, of course, had a big influence on our own country's history.
Absolutely. I loved reading that. I also love the Hemingway quote about be sure to get the weather in the book. Now, you know, of course, as well as anybody here does, we're coming up on the 15th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
Right.
And that's a storm that merits 17 pages in your book, which, considering it's a 500-year history, seems somewhat appropriate. So what were the challenges of writing about that storm?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is, I think, of all the hurricanes in the history of the United States, that hurricane is the one that has the most material to draw from. It certainly was the most expensive hurricane that we've ever experienced at $125 billion. But it involves so many different individuals, so many individual stories of human tragedy and perseverance, the intersection of local, state, regional, and federal government agencies and politicians. And it was a hurricane, since it occurred in 2005, when unlike a hurricane that might have occurred like Shiner Caminada in 1893, there was a lot more eyes watching this hurricane. The entire world, the entire country was watching it unfold, the disaster unfold. So it burned itself into the consciousness of America, and certainly your listeners and people in your part of the world. I can't imagine how devastating it must have been. And I've spoken to many people who sort of measure their life, if they live in an area that's been struck by a major hurricane, sort of before the hurricane and after the hurricane. I imagine that a lot of your listeners, before Katrina and after Katrina, it was a unique event in the history of hurricanes. And it was difficult to write about it. And I stayed up front that I'm only giving you the bare bones of the story, because you have a 500-year history. You have to be selective. But there's no way anybody could have written a history of America's hurricanes and not devoted considerable space to Katrina.
Well, you devote considerable space to Louisiana in general, and you actually open your book with a truly memorable scene in Cameron, Louisiana.
Actually, there's a funny story there. When I handed in the book originally, I didn't have that whole tableau of Hurricane Audrey to start off the book. And my editor said, you know, I think we need a really dramatic story to kick off the book. And so I looked around and I found the Hurricane Audrey story, which is just amazing, what happened to Dr. Clark and his wife, Sybil, and their family, and how they struggled through the hurricane and suffered such great loss, and his great professionalism being a doctor in Cameron Parish and going to treat the wounded, while at the same time he had no idea what was happening to his wife and three of his children, and as well as his housekeeper. And it's just a very dramatic story that I think, or I hope, grabs the reader with the great magnitude of these hurricanes, their impact both on individuals and larger regions, because hundreds of people died, and I'm sure everybody in that area remembers that storm who was old enough, and young people have probably been told about Hurricane Audrey. So I thought it was a great hurricane to use to open up the book and introduce the reader to what we were going to be talking about.
And also, there was an early warning sign that New Orleanians would completely appreciate.
Oh, the crawfish? Yeah, well, animals, that's really an interesting thing. I came across a number of references to how animals react to approaching storms. Mm-hmm. And this one was fascinating because I guess the crawdads, they can sense through barometric changes and changes in the pressure and other things that are happening in the environment that something very powerful is coming along, and they migrate a little bit or move inland to protect themselves. And there's another story about the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, which destroyed veterans' work camps in the Florida Keys. But right before that hurricane hit, fishermen were seeing tarpon swimming in between the different keys and going into the Gulf of Mexico, essentially. And they said, the old timers said, that's an indication that bad weather is approaching. And it makes sense because they're making mm-hmm. changes in the environment, and these animals want to protect themselves just like we do.
Well, in 1961, for Carla, I was a kid growing up in Texas City, Texas, and my dad worked at an oil refinery on Galveston Bay. And I remember him coming home in the middle of the night and saying, pack up your things, we have to evacuate, because there was an island in the bay that had a considerably large snake population, and all of the snakes had swum to shore and were kind of coming into the chemical plant.
Wow.
And they all took that as a sign of, well, let's go. I mean, it's just, and in retrospect, it was a very good thing indeed that we did. But you know, everybody has like their hurricane story or their storm. You know, there are New Orleanians who talk about Betsy like it just happened yesterday. And so I wonder, you know, living where you do, I mean, what is your experience with hurricanes? Do you have firsthand memories that were important to you?
No, here's where the truth comes out, that I'm a lightweight when it comes to experiencing hurricanes. I mean, people in my region, I live in Marblehead, Massachusetts. I grew up from New York. I was born in the New York area, but I spent most of my life in New England.
Mm-hmm.
And people in New England refer to the Great Hurricane of 1938 as the big one. It's a Category 3 that is the largest and most damaging and destructive natural disaster ever to strike New England. Obviously, I didn't live through that, but I have lived through the tail end or the remnants of some hurricanes. I remember very well Hurricane Sandy,
sure,
which when it slammed into New Jersey and New York, it was almost 1,000 miles wide, so everybody on the coast was being impacted, and there was major erosion and flooding very close to my house. I live about a quarter mile from the ocean, so we could see the remnants or the outer bands of Hurricane Sandy affecting us. Hurricane Bob in 1991, which slammed into parts of Massachusetts. There's a picture in the book of me in Falmouth, Massachusetts, standing on the beach next to a summer cottage that has been overwhelmed by Hurricane Bob. I was down there. My wife worked for the state, and she was involved in tree management. Mm-hmm. And so she snapped a picture of me. And if anybody gets the book, you'll see this picture. And what's most dramatic about it, I think, is not the house that has crumbled, but is my bright blue Hawaiian shirt, which my fiance, soon-to-be wife, made me get rid of when we got married because she couldn't stand it. And it was one of my favorite shirts.
Anyway, oh, wow.
So I have not lived through the direct impact, certainly a landfall, of a hurricane, but I can empathize with people that do. And I read hundreds of accounts of people that did live through that. And I'm young enough. I mean, I'm not that young, but hurricanes hit New England about 5 to 10 times a century.
Mm-hmm.
We are due up here. I am sure within my lifetime, and certainly the lifetime of my kids, there is going to be another hurricane of 1938, a Category 3, or perhaps with the warming of the ocean, maybe a Category 4.
You never know.
Strikes as far north as New England. So it's coming, but we're really relatively spared compared to your listeners on the Gulf Coast.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Eric J. Dolan, author of A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. Now, another one of the things I enjoyed in this book was your description of the way meteorology developed as a science along with our understanding of hurricanes, because that's what offers our only power in the face of these storms. Forecasting is what saves lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it started out, people just thought that hurricanes were God's will, and they came and went in their own design. And then slowly over time, people started investigating the patterns of hurricanes and what happened during hurricanes. Benjamin Franklin in 1743 became the first person to realize that hurricanes had forward movement. They didn't arise and sort of die in the same area, and that the winds in a hurricane could be contrary in direction to the direction in which the hurricane was moving. Then in the 1800s, there were massive battles between amateur and professional meteorologists over the nature of the hurricane, whether it was a circular storm or whether the winds were rushing in to the center. James Espy, one of the meteorologists, gave us the heat engine perspective on the hurricane, mm-hmm. which is that moist, warm air rises off the ocean's surface. And as it rises, the moisture condenses, releases a lot of latent heat that helps to power the storm. But it also creates almost a partial vacuum down near the surface of the ocean. And, of course, nature abhors a vacuum, so winds do rush in towards the center, but not straight in towards the center like James Espy thought. But later on, William Ferrell, who applied the Coriolis effect to winds, as those winds are rushing into the low pressure of the center of the storm, they're being deflected to the right in the northern hemisphere. And that's what gives us that swirling image of a hurricane. And overlaid on top of the scientific understanding of hurricanes that evolved during the 1800s was also the advances that we had in communication and being able to track hurricanes.
Right.
The telegraph was of major importance. And then towards the late 1800s, radios came online, or wireless telegraphy. So now ships at sea could report into land and tell people on land about an approaching hurricane. And then we move into the 1940s and we have the Hurricane Hunter planes.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly we can have a plane go out, fly into a hurricane with a lot of sophisticated weather measurement technology on board and give us real-time data about what that hurricane is doing. And then Hurricane Hunter planes are still being used today, but what did we get in the 1950s? Partially as a result of Russians and Sputnik going into the atmosphere, we get satellites, weather satellites. So now we're to the point where today we can track a hurricane from its inception to dissolution, and we have very powerful computerized models, weather models, that we can forecast the direction, power, and exactly where the hurricane is going. So that part of the history, the evolution and our understanding of what the greatest storms on Earth, which is what I call the hurricanes, what they're doing, what they are, how they operate, and how they're potentially going to impact us, is just absolutely fascinating, or at least I was fascinated by it.
Well, another thing I have to say about this book, and it was a great unexpected pleasure, this is a very pretty book. It's really, it's a pleasure to look at. I mean, there's so much art, there are prints and maps and drawings, and there's a good selection of art inspired by hurricanes. And there's also a very special little painting by a young artist named Lily. And I wonder if you'd talk about that.
Yeah, Lily is my daughter. She's now 23. And to tell you this story, I have to go back a little bit in time. When I was writing a book, which ultimately was titled Brilliant Beacons, The History of the American Lighthouse, I work on each of my books for almost 2 years before it goes off to the publisher to be produced. So my daughter at that time, years ago, was a teenager. She's also a very talented artist. She used to paint a lot with her grandmother, who's a professional artist. And I was taking a long time on this lighthouse book. So my daughter went over one weekend to her grandmother's house in her studio, took a picture. She had a picture of the Edgartown Lighthouse, which is on Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. She painted that lighthouse, a beautiful 18 by 20 inch painting. She brought it home that day. She handed it to me and she said, "Dad, this is to serve as an incentive to help you finish this book sooner." So I framed the painting, I put it up in my room, and I decided at that moment that if I could convince my daughter every single book from then on, I wanted to have a painting from Lily. So for my last book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, when I was approaching, which is a history of pirates in America, when I was approaching the end of that book, I said, "Lily, you have to do a painting." And so she went off and she did a very small painting of a pirate ship looking for its next victim, which is in that book. And then when I was coming towards the end of A Furious Sky, I reminded Lily again, at this time she was a college student and wasn't in the house anymore. So when she came home one weekend, I said, "Hey, books, I'm almost done. Got to do a painting." And she did a painting of palm trees being buffeted by hurricane force winds. So I just think that's really, it's a personal tradition. I like it. And a lot of people that have read my books, they say, "Well, what's Lily's painting going to be for the next book?"
So see? You just never know. You just never know. Well, I think you have partly the heart of a New Orleanian. I mean, you should come down for Pirate Week. You should come down for a hurricane. We can keep you entertained here, I'm sure.
I would love to. If it weren't for a COVID situation,
I know.
I was going to be coming down there this summer to give a book talk, but as you know, that's changed everything.
I know. So sorry. We've been talking with historian Eric J. Dolan, whose new book is A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. Eric will take part in a Zoom event with Jack Davis, author of The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. That will be Monday, August 31st at 6, sponsored by Garden District Bookshop. Check gardendistrictbookshop.com for information. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Sandy Rosenthal is an award-winning civic activist known for her work with the post-Katrina group Levees.org. She's been fighting to hold the Army Corps of Engineers accountable for 15 years now and shows no sign of letting up. Now she's chronicled her experiences in a new memoir, Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina. Sandy Rosenthal, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, one of the interesting moments of this book for me was the fact that you could pinpoint the exact moment you became an activist. And, you know, even the date, Friday, October 28th, 2005. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that moment, that galvanizing encounter.
Well, it can be boiled down to one word, anger. I felt angry that a resident of Louisiana, my home state, actually considered me and everyone who lived in New Orleans stupid for living in New Orleans and imbeciles for rebuilding. He felt that the flooding of New Orleans was due to a large storm and insisted that there was nothing wrong with the levees that broke. And that galvanized me to this conversation today.
Mm-hmm. And you brought a great set of skills to this cause. You graduated from the Tulane Business School. You had a background in marketing and copywriting, and you were a fitness instructor, so you had stamina, and you'd learn how to corral volunteers. You had a lot going for you going in to create this from nothing, really.
It was built from scratch, but you know, my son and I, my son was just 15 years old when he helped me design the website. We weren't thinking about, were we prepared for this moment? We weren't thinking about our tool set and our skills. We were only thinking about one thing, the work that needed to be done.
And there's nothing a committed woman and a teenage boy with computer skills cannot do. I mean,
apparently.
And Stanford comes out as a real hero in this story, I have to say.
He is.
One of the best kids ever. Now, so much of this story is about the quest for accurate information and the ability to make your way through bureaucracy and searching for the truth. And a lot of it is a paper chase, and you managed to make that exciting and interesting.
Thank you. And it's also something that I don't believe that the citizen at large understands, that we have at our fingertips a law that we can request anything we want from our federal government and also from our state governments. And I think it's an underutilized, misunderstood right of every person in the United States. And I hope that by writing Words Whispered, that I might have inspired more people to take advantage of that wonderful opportunity we have in America.
Mm-hmm. So August is always a difficult month for New Orleanians, and this year is a particularly big anniversary for our city. So talk a little bit about how you're doing, how you think the city's doing 15 years on. What do you do when the Katrina anniversary rolls around?
The month of August is generally a busy one for me and people like me who were civic activists and investigators. There's a lot of media. There's a lot of writing to be done, and it's usually very busy. But then as each day approaches, August 29th, it gets quieter and quieter because we're approaching a day of mourning.
Mm-hmm.
We go to church. We visit breach sites. We visit plaques, and it's a time of reflection. And we're getting close to that. And then here at the 15th anniversary, it's that plus some because of the 15th, and also because now a lot of the people in America have a little bit of a better feeling of what happened to us with what they're going through with COVID-19 and its effect. You know, the overnight change in the way of doing things, loss of jobs, children not being able to go to school, nursing home disasters.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways, the rest of the country has had just a small taste of what we went through 15 years ago. Fortunately for most people in this country now, they're not pushed out of their home. That's not true for everybody.
So what made you decide the time was finally right for this book?
7 years ago, 2013, mm-hmm. one of my closest and most trusted advisors picked up the phone, which is something he never does, and called me and said, "You need to write a book." And I said, "I know," with a sigh, because it's a big, big job.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, I was running levees.org. We still had many challenges facing us. It was not yet the 10th anniversary. But I knew he was right, because he's always right. He's my media advisor. And so I started writing that day. And it took me 5 years to complete, and then another year to find a publisher, but it was worth every minute.
And what do you want the reader to take away from this book? in some ways, you're writing for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, you're writing for New Orleanians as a representative of them.
I would say the biggest takeaway is that to beware, as the title says, words that blame a disaster on weather and on water. Now, beware those words, because almost always human beings are hiding behind those words. And that's the major takeaway that's right there on the cover of the book. But a second goal is to, again, if you see something that's wrong and needs to be fixed, speak up and say so. Sometimes all it takes is one person saying, excuse me, what? Wait a minute. Sometimes it just takes one person. And that's another thing that most people don't realize is how much power they have by opening up their own mouth.
The other thing that's so right about this book and wonderful is that it's a story of a woman finding her voice and using it in a cause that matters to her.
I did not know there was a civic activist inside me until October 28th, 2005.
Well, we're all lucky you found her.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Sandy Rosenthal about her new book, Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina. She'll be doing a Zoom event with Friends of the Cabildo Second Thursday Lecture Series, Thursday, September 10th at 6. You can go to levees.org for more information. Sandy, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.